You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I am Lindsay Ehrens. Let's go inside Utah politics. We begin our program with the wildfires burning across our state. Tens of thousands of acres torched by both natural and man-made sparks. But a familiar face has an idea for how Washington can help. I want to welcome to the program via Zoom Senator John Curtis. Senator, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great, Lindsay. Great to be with you.
It's so good to be with you. Okay, you have this Fix Our Forests Act. Talk to me about the main problem you see with the Forest Service land in Utah and how it's impacting wildfires.
Well, I'd point to a couple of things. The way we're managing the forest is, everybody can see, it's hugely problematic. And we've been limited in so many ways. And this bill finally gets Republicans and Democrats to come together and say, we need to manage these forests. So that's a big category. It also takes a look at the problems of interagencies working together and being siloed and bringing those together. It deals with forecasting these fires. It deals with what we do after the fires. It's really a comprehensive bill. And the fact that it's bipartisan and bicameral is really a good sign for Utah that I think we can get this bill passed.
Some have concerns with the way this kind of changes some NEPA regulations, environmental protections, right, for the land. That's kind of the holdup Republicans often argue about when it comes to fixing forests. They think there's too much bureaucracy, too much red tape. Does this get rid of that red tape, though, that's needed to help protect the environment?
So listen, remember, I've got two senators, one from California, one from Colorado, that are Democrats that are on this bill. We've worked really hard with their offices to find that good spot where we're moving quickly, but not disregarding these environmental standards. And the key to that is to be able to move quickly. And nobody can talk about this, of course, more than California and know how these have been impacted there. And so we had some real motivation to come together and find a good spot on this.
This also limits how lawsuits can be filed. Can you explain that part of the bill?
Yeah, I think, and going back to NEPA, one of the huge problems is the state of just using legislation to stop everything. And we deal with that, and here again, in a bipartisan way. And there's some actually really good things in this bill, not just for forest fires, but for NEPA in general, and how we deal with the whole issue of permitting going forward, that I think these will be landmark decisions that we're able to put in place that will help us in other areas as well.
Can you just give me a few specifics on, like, do we get in there and clear the forest better? Like, what does the bill actually allow us to do?
Yeah, so we got to remember, every forest is different, right? The forest in Utah versus California. But what we've had is a problem just getting in there and doing any work at all. And this better specifies under what conditions and how we can get in there. And remember to do it quickly and not be held up by these lawsuits. So it's really about a procedure to go do this that is just easier than what we had before.
Where does the bill stand now? Where does it go? How does it make it through Congress?
Great question. It's actually made it through the House. We made enough changes to it that we'll need to go back to the House. We'll go on our break here in just a couple of weeks. And I've talked with the committee chairman. As soon as we get back from break, this will go for a markup before the Ag Committee, which is where it goes. Here again, the fact that it's bipartisan is a really good sign. We think we can get it out of that committee and hopefully get it into law before the end of the year.
Let's switch to some of the headlines some of the topics that have made headlines in recent weeks. Congress just passed a spending cuts package that would cut about $9 billion from spending. Eight of that is with foreign aid, USAID, and then another $1 billion of that goes towards cuts with public broadcasting. Can you just explain your support for that bill?
Yeah, first of all, it's 0.1% of our overall spending. It's a tiny little bit, but it's a beginning of a course correction. And the fact that we're spending money where it's just not really in the taxpayer's best interest. Let me give you the foreign aid as an example. We're not saying we don't want to do foreign aid. What we're saying is, when we do, we want every dollar spent well, the way that Utahns would spend their dollars. And there's just a feeling that over the years, and quite frankly, over decades of doing these programs overseas, that they're not effective. They're not doing what they were originally intended to do. And when they're not, we need to peel that back and ask hard questions. Then where we have good answers, we'll go forward and continue to invest in overseas. But where money is not being spent well, it's time for us to stop and say enough.
Does this jeopardize any of our standing, if you will, with nations around the world where the U.S. comes in, helps with aid, helps kind of buoy up these other countries who can't maybe fund some of this humanitarian effort? Does it impact us in that way?
They call that soft power, and I think that's really important to the United States. And I'll point out that originally we had PEPFAR dollars in here to be cut. That's the aid vaccines that we're doing. And we pulled that out. We felt like, no, that is doing what we want it to do. It's saved 25 million lives around the country, around the world. And so, yes, let's keep that in. But to the point before is like, no, if we're spending dollars that are not having that soft power impact, that are not being spent well, that are not bringing value, then let's reevaluate those. So I think this will actually do more for that soft power in the long run, because we're reevaluating what's working and what's not.
And you're sure that these dollars that have been cut from USAID are not having the impact that you think they should be?
Oh, I tell you, you go through line by line and you'll see yourself. It's like, no, this is not where we want U.S. taxpayers' dollars going. And remember, we're spending a lot of money. We're peeling back just a tiny little bit of our budget to recalibrate and see if we can do it better.
Talk to me about the PBS cuts. How do you justify those cuts? PBS Utah, I'm in the local media. I was at PBS Utah yesterday for the governor's monthly press conference. They do critical work here in Utah. I have friends that work, colleagues that work for PBS Utah. How will these funding cuts impact them?
You've got PBS and NPR, and in both cases, what we're talking about is a tiny portion of their overall budget. And the question is, here again, if we have limited U.S. dollars, remember, we're spending $2 trillion more every year than we're bringing in revenue. We've got to peel back some places. I believe these programs will stay healthy. The vast majority of the money that is already coming from private contributions, the U.S. contribution is actually quite small. And what we're really saying is, look, it's time. You've been subsidized all these years. It's time to fly on your own. And I think they will, and I think those services will continue to be offered.
I hear you, what you're saying, that you think this isn't going to impact the broadcasting too much. But when it comes to looking at, kind of taking a 30,000-foot view, what President Trump is doing when it comes to making these cuts on public broadcasting, and then, just some other moves disparaging the media in certain ways, does it not give sort of a chilling effect on what we call the fourth estate here, media in general?
Yeah. Listen, we live in an era where there is more information available to people than ever before, and we're receiving it in different places. And all of that is going through a little bit of a transformation. For instance, this PBS and NPR money was put together in a time when there was no internet, when the only way you could get information in a rural town was through these stations. Well, that is totally different and totally changed. Really, what we're doing is saying, look, we're accommodating to 2025 and the world we live in. If anything, what this means is, if we're concerned about news getting out to the world, we should be doubling down on internet connectivity in rural Utah. That would do far more to get the word out and news out, if that makes sense, and for the fourth estate. But do it in a 2025 reality that life is just different and the people are getting their news in a very different way.
In our final few minutes here, I want to switch to public lands. You've done a lot of work on trying to do some land swaps, do different things where federal land can come back into Utah hands. I know that you're supportive of the lawsuit the state is filing, trying to claw back some of those federal lands. How do you see the rollout that happened with Senator Mike Lee when it came to the public lands issue in the Big Beautiful Bill? Did that hamper any of the work that you've done on this issue?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the narrative got away from us. And to me, it's just crystal clear. It's a false choice to say that we can't do a better job of managing these lands for the public to have access to them, and at the same time, give the state more control in areas that are so important to them. And I think some of the work we've done with public lands would validate that that can be done, that there is a place where we can recreate and protect and preserve these lands, where we can graze on these lands, where we can build housing in places like Moab that are just landlocked by these public lands. And what I regret about what happened is we just didn't do a good job with the narrative in helping people understand what it's really like in a small rural community in Utah when 94% of the land is owned by the federal government. And we need to have a conversation about how to help these communities thrive and protect these lands at the same time.
Who was responsible for that narrative, and how did it get away from you?
Well, so I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you the work we've done on public lands has been very well received. If you look at the Emery County Public Lands Bills and some of these others, I think we've done a really good job in bringing in these communities. And it just shows you how important it always is to bring in stakeholders, to be transparent, to let them see and bring them into to finding solutions. If you say, look, here's the problem, now we need a solution. Let's all participate in the solution. And I think that could help get rid of that false narrative that it's one or the other.
If you still want to claw back some of these lands, where does this issue go from here? Is there enough public support to get any of these lands back in state control?
Well, listen, we do, you know, this will surprise a lot of people who aren't paying close attention down in the weeds. We do these land swaps all the time. We did one with the Bonneville Shoreline Trail, where we had some wilderness that actually was coming down into residential areas. That didn't make any sense. We were able to swap that out for land and put that wilderness area somewhere else where it really did belong. And those types of things happen all the time. Now, it's true this was a bigger swing at doing a lot of that, and maybe the answer to your question is we need to break it down into smaller, more digestible pieces where people can see, okay, right, I'm okay with that. I can see how that's not impeding on public lands by doing that and actually enhancing it. And we'll continue in my office and me personally to work to find, right, these solutions that really do answer both of the important sides of this debate.
Final question of the interview. Do you want the Epstein files released?
Yeah. How did I know that question was going to come up? Listen, I'm just going to argue for transparency all day long. Whether it's the Epstein files or a county commission meeting or a city council meeting, I learned a long time ago as mayor, there's nothing better than transparency. And that'll make all these things go away if we're just more transparent as a government. So I would argue for transparency.
Is the administration being transparent enough with this?
Well, I think the outcry answers that question itself, right? As long as the outcry is there, we're not being transparent enough.
We will leave it there. Senator John Curtis, we so appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us on Inside Utah Politics. Well, still ahead here, Utah County will expand its collaboration with ICE. Why the County Commission approved the deal despite hours of negative public comments. Stay with us.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
And welcome back. The Utah County Commission voted unanimously this week to approve and formalize collaboration between their sheriff's office and ICE. Now, that vote came hours after hours of public comment, with people largely speaking against the move. Now, the crowd at times got rowdy despite assurances from county commissioners and the sheriff that they would make sure the deal works for the community.
If things are happening in this community that I'm not okay with, like ICE raids, then we're going to address those with ICE. This brings us to the table, and I'm asking for the community's trust. I'm your elected sheriff. I love this community.
Can you tell us your plan to prevent us from following Germany's game plan to the Holocaust?
Embarrassing.
I'm just here to help people.
You're about to close public hearing. We didn't have to listen to anybody today, Joseph, and you're about to ruin it for everybody else.
See there, the meeting got a little intense, and I'm joined today by one of those county commissioners, Amelia Powers Gardner. Thanks for your time, Amelia.
Absolutely.
Okay, so have you ever been to a meeting that got that rowdy before? I mean, you're in public service. This happens often.
I have. During COVID, we had several intense meetings, and I've been through a truth in taxation. So we've had a few intense meetings, but this one was definitely one of those top.
Yeah, this is an issue that definitely riles people up. So you enter in this 287 agreement with ICE. Mm-hmm. You voted unanimously to do that. You had a little bit of hesitancy in doing this, but at first I just want you to explain to me, what does this agreement actually do?
Yeah, there's been a lot of misconceptions about this. This agreement actually just gives us the ability to have open communications with ICE.
Okay, when you say that, though, I want to just make sure I understand. What does that mean? Because you're already communicating with ICE in terms of, like, when someone gets detained, right, and they've broken a law in Utah County, and you discover that their status is not legal, then you report them to ICE. So that's already happening. How does this change it?
Two ways. One, ICE is coming into our communities, and right now, when they come in and do things in Utah County, they don't inform us. We don't have any formal agreement that requires them to. And so we don't know where they are and what they're doing in our county.
So that now they changes. Have to inform you?
Yeah.
Okay.
The other part of this is it allows only our major crimes task force to have access to the ICE database. So as our major crimes task force is investigating and executing warrants for major crimes, they can also check the status of the people who have committed those crimes.
So these are the criminals who you believe are cartel folks.
Yeah.
And people.
Human trafficking, drugs, cartels, major crimes.
And so, I mean, the fear is that officers, local officers in Utah County could now pull someone over, profile them perhaps, look up their immigration status, and deport people without any due process.
Yeah, and that was really what a lot of the people were afraid about, with good reason. A lot of these folks have been in our communities for years, and their neighbors were afraid for them. That is not the intent. And it, not only that, but we won't even let those officers have access to it. The only officers that are going to be trained by ICE and have access to the ICE information are the Major Crimes Task Force. The other aspect of this that a lot of people misunderstand is they think that we will be giving additional information to ICE. That's not the case. The only time that we will be giving information to ICE is when we are now. And that is if someone has been arrested and they are illegal.
Talk to me about your hesitation to approve this agreement, because you hesitated, but it seemed like your other county commissioners and the sheriff really said, assuaged your fears a little bit. How did you get to yes on this?
Two reasons that I got to yes, but I'll start with what were my hesitations. I am a big advocate for civil liberties and for privacy. I tend to lean a little more libertarian than some of my Republican counterparts in this area. I have worked closely with the legislature to ensure citizen privacy from government, not just from consumers. And I wanted to make sure that this aligned with those values that I have. And so I wanted to make sure what information we were sharing, is it any more than we currently have? Are we sharing information with people that haven't committed crimes? I was very concerned about that. Those fears were completely calmed for me. One of the things that got me to a yes is the fact that this agreement can be canceled at any time. So if we feel that ICE has not kept up their end of agreement, which, by the way, our agreement requires them to provide translators for people that don't speak English. It gives a reporting line so that if there's violations, people can report them. We actually are going to get more securities for people in our county. If we feel they're not keeping their end of the bargain, we can cancel at any time.
How concerned are you that this could spread to ICE coming in doing farm raids or workplace raids or any other type of detaining in that way?
So we cannot control what ICE does. What we can control is that every person who steps foot in our jail gets due process. Whether they were brought there by ICE or by our sheriff's deputies, we can ensure they get due process. We can't control ICE, but we actually think that this will help us dissuade them from doing those types of raids. We don't want labor raids. The sheriff, you know, you saw him speak about that specifically. He said that his personnel will not participate in large-scale immigration and labor raids.
What do you believe are the misconceptions that are still out there that you would like to correct when it comes to this agreement that you signed? And maybe how is Utah County's agreement? Is it different than other counties that have signed a similar 287G agreement?
Yeah, you make a good point. There are several counties, almost half a dozen, I think, here in Utah that have signed this agreement that didn't have nearly this reaction. The reason why is in those counties, there weren't special interest groups that were purposefully spreading misinformation. The biggest misinformation pieces that I want people to understand is we are not inviting ICE into Utah County. We are not asking them to come and do raids. In fact, we've asked them not to do those labor raids. All we are doing is ensuring that when they are operating in our county, that we know about it. And hopefully securing more civil rights for all of our residents.
What was the most compelling public comment yesterday that you heard, maybe something you hadn't thought of or something that you're just like, you know what, that person has a point, that is concerning. What was that?
It was asking what information is being spread and ensuring that it wasn't just regular patrol officers who maybe, if somebody spoke to them snarky on a traffic stop, they'd look up their status, right? Those were valid concerns that I wanted to make sure that we had addressed before voting.
Okay. And then you said that if something goes wrong here, if you don't like the way ICE is behaving, or if there's some coordination not happening, you will terminate the agreement. You stand by that today?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And why is that important for people to know?
I think we really want them to know that we care about all the members of our residents and all of the members of our community. We all have a vested interest in ensuring that cartel members and violent criminals are not on our streets. And those that have entered the country illegally don't have a right to be here, especially when they're harming residents. The one concern that I do have that I really would love the public to know is we do not want this to dissuade any victims of crime from coming forward. We will not be going after victims of crime. We are not going to be giving victims information to ICE, only criminals.
We will have to leave it there. Commissioner Amelia Powers-Gardner from Utah County, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it. Well, coming up here on Inside Utah Politics, Governor Spencer Cox addressing cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, what the state plans to do when the big, beautiful bill takes effect. Well, protests in Utah move the needle in Washington. Attorney General Pam Bondi dropped all charges against a plastic surgeon accused of COVID vaccine fraud. Supporters from HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to Utah House Speaker Mike Schultz called Dr. Kirkmore a hero for giving out vaccine cards without administering the COVID shot and giving children saline shots at their parents' request. Now, we sat down with Dr. Moore. He tells us he's grateful for the support and has no regrets.
Well, I think COVID was all fake. I think it was just nothing but a lie from the beginning. I did the right thing. I have no regrets about what it was that I did. All I did was just follow my Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, and full informed consent, talking to my patients and making sure they understood the risks of the pros and cons of what it was that, you know, they could or couldn't get done.
Well, our Mackenzie Diaz sat down for a longer interview with Dr. Moore. You can find it on our website, abc4.com. Now, Utah Governor Spencer Cox wants to reassure Utahns amid concerns over the state's relationship with ICE. He says, while the state has no control over ICE, local agencies will do everything they can to make sure immigration enforcement is carried out the right way.
And racially profiling is not acceptable in our state, never will be. And we preach that and we enforce that, and we will continue to do so. What these agreements do allow us to do is to help with processing, to help when asked, and again, with under the discretion of the local sheriffs.
Now, the governor spoke this week at his monthly press conference. He also said there are no plans for new ICE facilities in Utah. Now, when asked about cuts to social programs like Medicaid and SNAP and the Big Beautiful Bill, Governor Cox said the state is making plans to fill the gap.
We'll look at programs. We've done some interesting things in the past to help people who are struggling with their health care. And we'll look back at those programs to see if there is a way to implement more in the future.
What about SNAP as well?
Yes.
Now, the governor also waded into the No Kings protest shooting controversy. He says this state warned organizers not to bring armed peacekeepers, but it's now up to the district attorney to decide if anyone will be held responsible for the death of Afa Alu.
Our DPS said it's a bad idea. You can do it. It's not illegal. There's nothing illegal about it. It's just a bad idea. And they said, well, we think it's a good idea. End of conversation. A lot of people are responsible for what happened, and it's a terrible tragedy. My heart goes out to his family.
Now, I also got the chance to ask the governor about Senator Mike Lee's now deleted tweets about the Minnesota lawmaker shootings last month. This happened in their home. State lawmakers there shot dead in their home. Now, the governor kept his response very short, simply calling the posts awful. Well, that's going to do it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Stay in touch with us on social media, if you will. You can find me on X and Threads at Lindsay on Air. Lindsay spelled with an A. On Instagram, just search for Lindsay Ertz. You can also find Inside Utah Politics in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts. Well, if you're looking for more national political coverage, how about checking out our new show from our Next Door National Network? It's called Political Power Ranker. Our national political director and the head of Emerson College Polling look at who's up and who's down in the world of politics based on the data. Now, we carry that for you on our free streaming app, News for Utah Plus. You can download that on Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, and Apple TV. Well, thanks for being with us, everyone, and we will see you next week.